Welcome to Now You Know Politics. I'm Catherine Sussman.
And I'm Rob Laidlaw.
Today, we'll be talking about animals in the classroom, everything from the use of animals in dissection to live animals in the classroom to school visits to zoos and aquariums and other animal-related facilities. Thanks for joining us. So, Rob, how are you doing today?
Not too bad. Very busy, but happy to discuss these issues.
Excellent. Have you been enjoying your summer?
Not really. It's been all work, playing catch up on a variety of issues, but it's always interesting.
Cool. So just to get started today, is there anything that struck you about NYK Experts Uncut episodes that we've recorded on dissection? So we did two, one with Dr. Lori Marino and one with Dr. Elizabeth Ormandy.
Yeah, what really surprises me is the fact that this is still going on. I remember being involved with a group run by a husband and wife team out of Washington more than 30 years ago. And the group was called Student Action Concern for Animals. And they were primarily focused on dissection issues. And at that time, they were trying to make it a big issue and they had succeeded to a certain degree. But I'm still surprised that this is an issue that to me is so meaningless and so absurd that it's still around to the extent that it is. And I know there's lots of people out there that oppose it. There's lots of kids. Preparing to talk to you today, I looked at a couple of articles. One of them was a peer-reviewed paper by Jonathan Balcom from 1997, and he talks about a helpline for kids opposed to dissection or others opposed to dissection in schools that at the time his paper was written had received over 100,000 calls. So, you know, there's a lot of people that are opposed to it, but it's still around, and it's still around to a degree that it shouldn't be around given how long it's been an issue. So I think in listening to the interviews, that sort of surprised me that it's still so prevalent. You know, there have been some moves forward in terms of giving students choice in that, but it's still a huge problem.
I agree. It really shocked me talking to Elizabeth Ormandy about it because on every single level, so she began by just talking about how you actually have better learning. And there were so many, I think she said over 60 studies done that basically proved the efficacy of alternatives to dissection over like an actual dead animal. So you have better learning. It's more environmentally friendly. It saves the school system a fortune. It's safer in terms of, you know, not putting scalpels into the hands of children. And it's healthier because children are exposed to formaldehyde and all kinds of things when you're using dead animals, never mind the animal welfare component, right? So it is surprising to me that it's still so predominantly leaning toward the side of actually using dead animals rather than other alternatives.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head too with saying that, you know, it's not very effective in teaching kids. Honestly, I don't think you can learn very much from dealing in any way, shape, or form with pickled animals. I think it creates a culture of use, exploitation, and dominance. I think if you really want to learn about animals, look at what's around us, and that will be far more beneficial than, you know, looking at animals that have been taken out of a jar of formaldehyde or preserved in some other way. The other thing I wanted to say is that a lot of people talk about alternatives to dissection, and I don't think that is really the way to look at it. Certainly when you're talking about high school and elementary school levels, because I think it's absurd that you would kill millions of animals so that these kids could dissect them for no purpose. And I don't think alternatives is a good word because it implies that there's some worth in doing that activity that requires an alternative. Even if there was no alternative, I would say get rid of it. It's absurd and it's teaching people all the wrong things.
And actually, that's what really struck me about the interview we did with Dr. Marino on this subject, because she really focused on the fact that emotionally, what is this inculcating into our children? And it really can contribute to just a more violent outlook, never mind a disrespect for animals.
Absolutely. And it also creates this attitude of compliance with the system. the many problems that we face today aren't the result of people speaking out. They're the result of too many people not speaking out. And this just sort of reinforces that idea that you shouldn't speak out or that it's difficult to speak out. I think everywhere this is done, they should be encouraging students to speak out if they want to. Don't just give them an option that maybe they'll go to if they're brave. Tell them, you know, right up front, you know, if you have concerns, speak out. And I think that would be a fantastic lesson in and of itself.
There's a really interesting article that came out a few years ago called The Battle Over High School Animal Dissection. It was written by Nicole Shine, and it talked about students, now with social media, students posing with dead animals and making fun of the animals, and this actually becoming a whole social media problem. Kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, that's something that I am not at all surprised with, because back when I was in school, I remember dissection started in grade 5, and I was always a science geek because I did other things, but super interested in science, on all the sciences. I was always near 100% every course, and I would see so many other people in my classes at the time that either were disgusted by it or treated it like a huge joke. Mm-hmm. And they would get, I remember there were perch, there were frogs, there were earthworms, there were other creatures, and it was just this big joke to them. And I thought, what a needless waste of life. And for me, I just said right from the get-go, I like animals. This is ridiculous. Screw it. And I just said, I'm not doing this. And I challenged them, and they backed down, and you know, I just continued on. I think, you know, more
and I had the opposite experience. Yeah. I refused to do it, and I didn't continue on because I was too timid.
Yeah. Certainly, I've heard of a lot of people doing that. They just opt out of the course because they don't want to do the dissection.
That's what I did.
I think it's inevitable that eventually there will be some type of legislative resolution of the dissection issue on some level. But it's been something that's occurred over the years, and a lot of what's gone on just sort of lies there in the dark recesses of history and requires a great deal of research to find. But, you know, it really does show that this should be dealt with. I think the reason there hasn't been any legislated resolution to this in any area to date is just because it's so ingrained in that school and university and science institution culture. It's not that it serves any useful purpose. It's just that it's ingrained.
It's an antiquated system. You find the same thing. I went to the CCAM conference a few years ago, and that's in Windsor. They have an amazing facility there now, which is dedicated solely to like alternatives to testing on animals in science. And it's the same sort of thing when it comes to biomedical research. So many tests are still done on animals, and it's a complete waste, because when they go to human trials, they're no longer effective. They can't reproduce the same results in humans. So the research is all done needlessly, yet the system is such that even if something is done and it's not originally tested on animals, it has to be redone and tested on animals in order to have a drug be approved. It's just absolutely nuts. There's just a huge amount of animal life wasted for antiquated reasons.
Well, and we see that in all aspects of our society. We see that, you know, generally speaking, the institutions, the political processes, and many other things in our life that we're governed by really need to be revamped. They're relics of the past, and maybe at one point in time they had some purpose or usefulness or whatever, but I would say that a lot of these things today, they really don't. And, you know, unfortunately, those systems and those processes are resistant to change. And it's very, very challenging for anyone who cares to change those things. But, you know, they can be changed if enough of us get involved.
And this is why it's so important just for people to spread the word, in this case, that in Canada, if you don't want to dissect, they can't actually force you, and they can't not pass you. They have to provide an alternative.
And every parent should make that known to their kids, and they should be talking to their school board representatives or to the school boards themselves. They could be talking to their schools. it's lack of a dialogue on this particular issue, I think, or this group of issues that really sort of allows them to continue.
It's also important that if somebody's listening to this, that they inform teachers that they know how easy it really is now. Like if you go to the Animals and Science Policy Institute website, it's so easy to just order, you know, whatever animal it would have been that you wanted to do a dissection project with in your classroom. You can now get like a computer model. So, so easy.
You know, you can even do that at higher levels of education. If people honestly believe there's a need in, you know, medical schools or veterinary schools, then they can use cadavers, they can use other things.
And most programs aren't even doing that anymore. Where did I read that recently? Like a lot of vet programs don't use animals.
Yeah, and I've met veterinarians who never did any kind of dissection or anything like that. And the first time they dealt with animals was when they were mentored in a real life situation. So in a veterinary hospital or some other kind of a clinic setting where they had done all the preliminary work that did not deal with harming animals in any way. And then their hands-on stuff they learned under the mentorship of an experienced person.
Why don't we just chat a bit about live animals in the classroom? This is also a huge problem because so many schools, so many teachers will bring exotic pets into the classroom.
Yeah, this is something I've encountered. Certainly through ZooCheck, we get calls every year sometimes from teachers, sometimes from students or parents, where animals have been brought into a school and they can be all kinds of different animals. They can be fish or frogs. They can be invertebrates. They could be pocket pets, you know, gerbils, mice, rats. They can be hedgehogs. And certainly reptiles, too, are reasonably popular. But we do get calls from people saying, you know, the school empties on the weekend, the custodians are there cleaning the school, but other than that, nobody's there and these animals are left alone. We've had calls from teachers that have said, everybody left, this poor lizard is stuck in the aquarium, I had to take it because nobody else was here. What do I do with it? So we get these kinds of calls. And then I'm also a children's author and I do school visits. So when I go out to schools, I often encounter animals in the school. So they can be in the school lobby, it could be an aquarium full of fish, but often they're in individual classrooms as well, and there's supposed to be an educative component to having those animals there. And again, in most of these situations, I don't think it's a good idea. I think the animals suffer, and a lot of times they're, for all intents and purposes, abandoned when the holidays come around.
And is there no regulation surrounding this? Like, where are these animals sourced from? Where do they come from? Where do they go when the programs end? What kinds of numbers are we talking about?
We've never really looked at that, or I haven't. I think it would be useful for someone to do that kind of study.
You've been trying to get me to do that for you for a long time. I haven't done it yet.
Anecdotally, from, you know, the people I've talked to and teachers that I've spoken to, there's a whole variety of sources. Sometimes they may come actually from a student's residence where, you know, a student will have this animal at home and bring that animal in. Sometimes it will be the teacher or somebody else that's in the faculty of a school that will bring the animal in. And there's also, as you know, all kinds of businesses that rent out animals. And I would imagine that some of those animals are not recovered by those businesses and are left in the schools.
When I was a kid, we had ducks, and that we had a duck in the classroom, and then she gave birth, and we had all these little ducklings. And then when the school year ended, my mom ended up taking the ducklings and the mother duck home, and we had them all summer. I actually don't even remember what happened in the end. Like, as they got bigger, I should actually ask my mom about that. But like, nobody would take them. So I remember this exact situation where my mom said, "What are we going to do? I guess I'm going to take the ducks."
Well, rather than be all doom and gloom, I can tell you about just recently I was at a school and I saw a very good situation involving ducks. And all of the kids in the school were absolutely fascinated. And while I was at the school, I was there for about half a day. Every time I went by where the ducks were, there were loads of kids packed there watching the ducks. But these weren't ducks that were brought into a classroom. They had a courtyard in the school with a small pond, and a female mallard had come in and had laid her eggs, and she had 12 babies. And so the babies were confined in the courtyard, and the mother during the daytime would fly away out of the courtyard and then come back. But all of these kids were learning about these ducks and how the mother interacted with her young and all of that. And they were actually quite knowledgeable about ducks. And this was a wild duck that had come into that situation. I think that really sort of provides direction when you're thinking about animals in schools. Maybe they should be attracting animals to the schoolyards, whether they're birds or mammals or whatever. Could be a flower garden for hummingbirds and bees. It could be anything. That's a much better, more benign, more beneficial way of getting kids involved with animals than bringing them into the classroom. Bring natural wildlife to the school. Thinking along those lines, let's try to get kids involved with real wildlife, with native wildlife, not wildlife or nature in a box in the classroom.
What can we do, you know, as just average citizens about this issue, considering it's unregulated?
Yeah, I think it's incumbent upon anybody who's concerned about this that encounters this problem, especially if it's with their own child in school, to be the force of change. So to talk to the teacher, you know, not in a confrontational way, but to talk to the teacher before doing that, to do a little bit of research about the animal so you have some understanding about what that animal's needs are and what ramifications are of that animal being in the classroom. There's lots on the internet these days. So, you know, bringing it up with the teacher, the principal or vice principal, and then if there's no satisfactory response, to then take it to a higher level, possibly a school board level. And ultimately, what would be very good is if people were advocating for school system-wide policies on how animals can be used or if animals can be used. Preferably, there'd be no use of animals except in very certain kinds of situations in a school at all. But I would say just be an advocate, start off small, and just go up the chain of command.
And speaking of that, shouldn't there also be school board policies that are more progressive when it comes to school visits to animal facilities? Because right now I find that even the most progressive schools in Toronto, which is where I have a child in the school system, I find that even if you're looking at like independent schools or some of the best private schools, often the visits are still just to places that, you know, we certainly wouldn't encourage or condone, like the Ripley's Aquarium, for example, or some of the smaller, lower-tiered roadside zoos. So shouldn't there be school board policies on this? Like, isn't this something that we should also be encouraging parents to bring up with their children's schools?
Absolutely, because you've got all kinds of facilities. You mentioned Ripley's Aquarium. You mentioned the roadside zoos. Virtually any public animal facility in this province, no matter how bad, has a certain percentage of their visitorship comprised of students on school visits. And there's lots of problems with that. It's, you know, normalizing the abuse of these animals in the worst facilities. There's normalizing the use of animals for what, for all intents and purposes, is entertainment.
It's normalizing captivity generally.
It's normalizing captivity. But also there's other issues, because a lot of these school kids are unknowingly brought into situations that are potentially dangerous. So a lot of the animal contact situations where there's no disease mitigation pose a risk. There are many zoos in the province where the caging is actually dangerous. So, you know, there's zoos that I've been to. Because we have no standard in the province for safety in zoos, there's zoos that I've been to in the province where big cats, like tigers and lions, are kept behind fences that are 2 meters high. The standard for keeping big cats in professional zoos and sanctuaries would be for an animal like an African lion, a robust, properly constructed fence, at least 14 and a half feet high. I don't know, what is that, about 4 meters high. And 5 to 6 meters high for tigers. Yet, even though, you know, these roadside zoo facilities are keeping these animals behind 6-foot fences, there's still reams of school kids that are coming in that don't know any better. The teachers don't know any better. I would say that it's a huge problem. Eventually, there's going to be a child that's going to be killed or maimed, and that schools, on an individual basis or on a school board basis, preferably it would be the province, would dictate that, you know, if you're going to go to any of these places, there's certain criteria that have to be satisfied. You can't just take all the kids from your school every year to the local zoo because it's there. You know, they should have criteria that must be satisfied before kids can be taken into any of these places. And I think there should be alternative education. If they're going to do school visits to these kinds of places, they should also have information promoting the other side. And there's actually quite a number of good educators and children's books that look at, should we go to the zoo? Should we have exotic pets? Things like that, that look in a very, very intelligent way at all of the arguments on both sides. And that's, exactly, that's lacking now.
Really what we need is a cultural shift, really, a shift in mentality about, because it is, you know, as we talk about over and over, it's just not the right kind of education when you're going to these facilities in terms of how we want children to feel about, you know, other species on this planet and environmentalism, conservation, and animal welfare. So I think if you're a parent, well, what are your recommendations? I would say it's better to talk to your school about potentially going out to a nature reserve. If you're in Toronto, what about a class trip to the Leslie Spit and go on a nature walk or something like that? Something to appreciate, as you were saying, the local wildlife right outside on the school grounds, something like that. Because people do want their children, and children do want to interact with animals. So we don't want to say, like, look, have nothing, don't just, you know, get rid of all these programs altogether and let's not expose children to animals. But perhaps some alternatives can be implemented, and some of which can be, you know, films and, you know, using the internet and all of that to learn about species. And but then in terms of that tactile experience, are there places that you do recommend? What are your thoughts on that?
I think the opportunities to engage with nature and with animals are endless. I do it myself. I have many parks and I'm in the city and I can go to any one of these parks. I can find amphibians. I can find all kinds of small mammals. I find, you know, bats flying in the sky, birds. There's all kinds of different plants. You know, there are systems out there that you can actually go and you can find out all about these systems and look and find their inhabitants. You can engage with those animals. You know, I've done some bat walks with kids where, you know, you go out at night with a bat detector and they didn't even know there were bats in the areas that they live, and they're just fascinated by that. Of course, there's bird watching.
It's really funny. I'm interrupting you because I had said to you, remember recently I was at a lake and I was like, wow, like there was so much wildlife all around me. And I just couldn't believe, I was like, has there been some sort of problem with frogs breeding or an invasive species? And you're like, no, you're just starting to actually notice natural indigenous wildlife now that you're, you know, doing all this work on welfare issues.
And I would challenge people to look for nature right around them because it literally is everywhere. All you have to do is look. And if you don't know where to look, then start Googling because you will find ways of instructing yourself on how to look. You know, there are people that are avid ornithologists or even amateur bird watchers that go out and they find a plethora of species right here in the city. There are people that do all kinds of things. But I did want to point out that if that's not your thing, then there are other alternatives. There are other places where you can view animals, where they either congregate. So like there's a place called the Fort White Nature Center in Winnipeg where thousands and thousands of geese come every night because that's a safe place for them to be at night. You know, fantastic place. You've got, you know, High Park here in Toronto where you get congregations of waterfowl, you get coyotes. You get
the cormorants, the Leslie Spit.
Right. So you've got places, natural places like that where animals congregate, but we've also got in Canada and in the United States and other parts of the world, other kinds of facilities where you can actually go and view animals if, you know, they're captive, but they're not sort of your typical
zoo type facility. I think what the problem is, one of the problems here is just that we do not tend to appreciate the smaller species. So we're very wrapped up with them. We've kind of been trained to be fascinated by the megafauna, you know, exotic foreign species, right?
Yeah. You actually hit the nail on the head. This is one of the criticisms of zoos generally, is that they focus on, you know, those large flashy, charismatic species like panda bears and lions, tigers, elephants.
Polar bears,
those kinds of creatures, when in fact, you know, what they're showing people, if you go to the Toronto Zoo, what they're showing is really a skewed perspective on life on Earth. Most animals on Earth are small, and many of them are infinitely fascinating. But yes, I think you're 100% correct. People have been trained into thinking that, oh, those animals don't matter, or they're not as interesting, when in fact they are. And this is something that zoos and other places that really want to teach people about nature or about ecology, that's something they should be telling people, and they really don't.
It would be amazing just to have like a little insect sanctuary or outdoor place where you can go and, you know, to just learn all about tiny little insects. I saw an incredible yellow caterpillar yesterday, and it was so large and fluffy. I had never seen anything like it. And it just really made me realize how little I focus on the smaller species.
There really is nature everywhere. It's all around us. You know, we don't need to bring an animal in a box in a classroom. We don't need to go down to see confined animals in a local zoo to experience nature. All we need to do is change our perspective.
Rob, thanks so much. Always fantastic to talk to you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.